We've been talking a lot about film lately. We recently had an episode called Dirty Words and Filthy Pictures. It was all about film censorship and a book by attorney Jeremy Geltzer. We've gotten great responses on that episode, and if you want to listen to it, you can go to iTunes and or you can go to the Montpelier website and listen to the podcast. But today we're also going to talk about film, and we're going to ask a different question. The question is this: can you make wonderful art? Can you make a wonderful film that is nonetheless just a terrible message? Can art function as a vehicle for hatred and bigotry? Well, the answer, according to our guest today, Dick Lehr, is definitely yes. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about a film called Birth of a Nation.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
I made it all the way to college without ever having seen Gone with the Wind. And when my girlfriend, who was from the South, heard that, she was shocked, appalled, dismayed, and intended very quickly to get me down to the theater and see it when it was shown on campus. And I enjoyed it. Gone with the Wind is a remarkable technical accomplishment. It's a compelling film. It's entertained millions of people. For many years, it was the box office champion. But from the very first time I saw it, I thought to myself, wait a second, what is the message here? And what is the depiction of this institution of slavery? And wow, what a contradiction between the message and the art. Well, that contradiction was not new. In fact, Gone with the Wind was following in a tradition that had been established decades earlier, and most notably with a film that's universally acknowledged as one of the great accomplishments in the history of film, but simultaneously one of the worst, most horrible racist screeds in human history. The film is called Birth of a Nation. It's by a very famous director called D.W. Griffith. And it's been just about 100 years since its premiere. And so it's appropriate that a professor of journalism at Boston University, a fellow by the name of Dick Lehr, has written a book about it. And today he's going to tell us all about it.
My name is Dick Lehr, and I'm an author and journalist, and I teach journalism at Boston University.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating career and very public service oriented as well.
Well, I like to think that way, and I try to pass along to my students the excitement I've always had for journalism is making a difference.
Well, I think it does, and I think there has to be a certain element of altruism these days. It's a tough, tough profession to be in these days, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and it's a lot of it's, you know, rediscovering the model to make journalism sustainable, but there's certainly always a need for people who know how to research and verify and then write up their findings in a readable fashion.
Which is exactly what you have done with a fascinating new book called Birth of a Nation, which is why we're talking today.
Well, thanks for that.
Absolutely. Tell us about it.
Well, it's a book built around America's first blockbuster film, The Birth of a Nation, by the legendary filmmaker D.W. Griffith. And which came out 100 years ago in 1915. It was at the front end of a media revolution, in effect, the feature film, and it just blew everyone away. The problem, and it's a big one, is that the content is racist. It's an epic story of the American Civil War and Reconstruction, but it's told from a very Southern sensibility because D.W. Griffith was a born and raised in Kentucky, and so it upon its release, it met with a lot of opposition in the black community and among their supporters. And for me, the book is essentially a protest drama. I was in my research amazed and surprised and fascinated by the protests that developed, especially in Boston, for 3 months in the spring of 1915, that showed many of the sort of protest strategies that we all came to know and see throughout the 60s and 70s.
So who was in charge of these protests up in Boston?
At the forefront, there was a newspaper editor by the name of William Monroe Trotter. And in many ways, the book is an attempt to kind of reclaim him, rediscover him from the dustbins of history. Because I was surprised. Here I am, Boston-based. I've been a journalist here for several decades. I teach journalism at BU. And you know, 4 or 5 years ago when I got into this project, I ran across Monroe Trotter and virtually knew nothing about him. The more I read into it, the more I discovered that in the early 1900s, he was a nationally prominent newspaper editor and civil rights leader. often mentioned in the same breath as W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, who were, you know, still are household names in effect. So I started reading into him just out of curiosity, and then and learned, for example, that he was the first Black Phi Beta Kappa to graduate from Harvard.
Wow.
And that he started his newspaper as a way to confront Booker T. Washington and a civil rights strategy that Trotter considered to be ineffective, and in fact so ineffective that civil rights were in the backsliding.
If I may interrupt you, there was a couple of fascinating things you mentioned in your book. You pointed out that the civil rights movement among African Americans was not monolithic, and you had the Booker T. Washington more accommodationist school of thought, and then you had W.E.B. Du Bois and the others, the forerunners of the NAACP, who were a bit more assertive. And Trotter was on the assertive side of that dispute, wasn't he?
Again, he established his newspaper, The Guardian, in order to challenge Booker T. Washington and to try to tell America that Washington does not speak for all of Black America. White America assumed and believed, because Booker T. Washington was so famous and prominent, and the Black press just wasn't, you know, widely distributed. And Trotter felt strongly about education, higher education, about voting rights, about political rights. He felt it was important to get in a white man's face.
Mm-hmm.
It's challenging. And to not have this kind of get along, go along, let's learn a trade and slowly work our way into the fabric of, you know, American society. No, he wanted his place at the table now.
And he came by it honestly, because his father, of course, had been a Civil War veteran. He was, in fact, part of the famous Massachusetts Regiment of African Americans, wasn't he?
He was. His father, James Trotter, was not only a member of the regiment, the all-black regiment from Massachusetts, but the father himself, became a civil rights advocate within the military. During the Civil War, he was fighting for equal pay for blacks. He was writing letters and lobbying for the unequal pay, but also the ability to get promoted beyond a sergeant, which he was. He eventually won, became a lieutenant of his unit. So, you know, this is the environment and the atmosphere that the son, Monroe Trotter, grew up in, a father who was always standing his ground.
D.W. Griffith from Kentucky, which was a border state, and there were people on both sides of the Civil War there, but his father was also in the Civil War, and he was one of the so-called wild Kentuckians, wasn't he?
Yeah, the Orphan Brigade from Kentucky that did join because the state of Kentucky was on the sidelines and did not join the Confederacy. But you had this, what became known as the Orphan Brigade, soldiers like D.W. Griffith's father who went and fought for the Confederacy. Yeah, he became known as Roaring Jake Griffith. He was a colonel in the Confederacy who fought heroically, was wounded several times, and came home to a large family and basically became the local raconteur and heavy drinker who, you know, reveled in Civil War stories. And that was the atmosphere that young D.W. Griffith grew up in. I learned that at the end of the Civil War, in the winter of 1865, the Orphan Brigade from Kentucky, featuring D.W. Griffith's father, was in Charleston, South Carolina, was fleeing the city as James Trotter and his all-black unit from Massachusetts was part of a Union force that was taking over that city. They were literally miles apart from each other at the end of the Civil War. And then you jump fast forward 50 years to 1915, which is the centerpiece of the drama in the book, and the sons faced off, in effect, in a different kind of Civil War.
But in order to get to that, you have to first add another character, and this was a friend of Griffith's who was an author of a novel, right?
Thomas Dixon, a very popular novelist in the early 1900s, was writing a trilogy about the the Civil War years in the South. His third book in that trilogy was called The Klansman, and that became the basis for D.W. Griffith's film, an adaptation of The Klansman that became known as The Birth of a Nation. And Dixon was a raging, extreme racist. He didn't try to sugarcoat it in any way. He saw his book and he saw the movie as a propaganda film that he was quoted in a number of places saying that he hoped to convert every Northern viewer into a true Southerner. Griffith's own film career had been evolving and growing, producing and directing shorter films. And by 1913, 1914, he was stretching his wings. So that's what he wanted to go there. He's very ambitious, both in a technological way in terms of using the new technology, but also in an artistic way, wanting to tell a big story. And when someone he knew introduced him to The Klansman, it seemed a perfect storm, to use that cliche, of events, where Griffith was looking for a big story. Here's a story about the Civil War and Reconstruction, which is, you know, right in his sweet spot, so to speak, being a son of Warren J. Griffith. It all came together that this was a chance for him to make a big impression, an epic film built around the American Civil War.
And how was the film received?
It blew audiences away. A lot of it had to do with the artistry and the techniques that Griffith brought to bear that hadn't really been marshaled before, at least before American viewers. I mean, most films in those days were simply, you plunk a camera down and you start it, and it's as if you're pointing it at a stage, and then you have the actors moving back and forth in front of it in the silent film. Griffith was pioneering in shooting a scene from, multiple perspectives. And camera setups. You start with a master shot, and then you break it down, and you do one character's point of view, and then another character's, and you shoot a lot of film, and then in the editing room, you cut it so that you enhance the viewing experience. You're grabbing the viewer by the throat and bringing them up close. You did a lot of close-ups, the fade in, the fade out, all techniques that we take for granted now and are part of the ordinary practice of filmmaking. Griffith was a pioneer in pushing the envelope, and you had audiences applauding, cheering, standing on their feet in a lot of the war scenes that he reenacted, which, again, another thing, he reenacted Civil War scenes in a scale and a scope that hadn't been done on film before. So it was a huge commercial success.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Boston University journalism professor Dick Lehr about his new book called The Birth of a Nation. It's about the film of that title that is both an artistic triumph and a terrible bit of racist propaganda. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and we'll finish our discussion with Dick Lehr. So stick around. Now it's time for our constitutional quiz, recorded before a live audience at James Madison University with the quiz prez, Jonathan Alger.
And now we have a Republican. I met this guy at lunch. What's your name, sir?
My name is Josh Humphreys, and I'm a senior political science major.
And a Republican.
And a proud Republican.
A proud Republican. Okay, thanks, Josh. And Josh, I'm going to give you some props because Josh was one of the prime movers, if not the prime mover, behind this brand new election district that's going to be centered here at JMU. So I think we all owe you thanks for all your efforts there. And that's also part and parcel and a great example of this entire vision of a civically engaged university. So well done, young man, well done. All right.
Can I move to a difficult one since Josh
is
here?
Yes, let's really hammer. He's a Republican, let's hammer him.
There we go.
Come on.
All right, let's see here. Josh, let's go with Patrick Henry, probably one of your heroes, right? So this is now keep in mind, of course, Patrick Henry had his run-ins, right, with James Madison and was a great orator, which James Madison, by the way, was not. When we're looking for great Madison quotes, sometimes it's actually hard to find really short, pithy quotes, right? We have a few, but Patrick Henry was quite the orator in his day. So this is Patrick Henry. Give me leave to demand. What right had they, referring to the drafters of the Constitution, to say, we the people? My political curiosity, exclusive of my anxious solicitude for the public welfare, leads me to ask who authorized them to speak the language of we the people instead of we the states. States are the characteristics and the soul of a confederation. If the states be not the agents of this compact, it must be one great consolidated national government of the people of all the states. So this quote by Patrick Henry expresses the anti-federalist, A, fear of a strong national government, B, acceptance of separated and shared powers, C, fear of tyranny of the majority, or D, acceptance of the necessary and proper clause?
I'm leaning towards answer B.
Okay, what was B again?
B was acceptance of separated and shared powers.
You think Patrick Henry accepted shared powers?
Let's hear them just one more time. That was quite, that was a,
sure.
That was a lengthy quote.
I'm not trying
quote.
To talk you out of it.
Just,
okay.
I had to pick a hard one for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate
so,
that.
So A was fear of a strong national government. B was acceptance of separated and shared powers. C was fear of tyranny of the majority. And D was acceptance of the necessary and proper clause.
Well, I think I may change my answer. I may go to answer A. If he seemed like he was a person that was, you know, really in favor of the states having the most authority.
What was answer A again?
Fear of a strong national government.
Right, so he would want the states to have more of the power then.
So you're saying Patrick Henry was a scaredy cat. Is that what you're saying?
Your words, not mine.
But that's what you're saying?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay,
yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
That's right. So you like answer A better?
I would probably go with answer A.
Quiz Prez?
And the correct answer is A, fear of
well
a strong
done.
National That's why they're called the anti-federalists, right?
Indeed. No, that was a lengthy okay. quote, and sometimes when you have those lengthy
yes.
quotes, you have to pause and think about exactly what they mean.
Exactly.
That was part and parcel. That was basically Patrick Henry's clarion call. That was his basic position. In fact, a quote often, I think, misattributed to him is that when he first started hearing about what happened at the Constitutional Convention, supposedly he said he smelt a rat. I don't know that we've actually got evidence that he said that, but that crystallizes this, and that's why it was so important that he didn't show up too early.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Dick Lehr, who is a professor of journalism at Boston University and the author of a new book called The Birth of a Nation. It's about the film, the famous film by D.W. Griffith of that same title, and about its impact and how it was received all the way about 100 years ago. And it was just a phenomenon. It was very much like Gone with the Wind, not just an artistic success, but an enormous commercial success. And one of the reasons for that success was a fellow who's been in the news lately. He was both a president and, I'm sorry to say, a racist.
The deeper I got into, you know, in trying to reconstruct this story, to realize, it's one that plays out on a huge canvas because there's a roll call of famous figures, including President Woodrow Wilson. Wilson and the author of The Klansman, Thomas Dixon, had known each other since college. And Dixon, in addition to being racist and a propagandist, was an amazing sense of public relations and marketing, because he called on his old friend and told the president that there's this new thing, this new movie that he just got to see, especially because it relies on some of Wilson's own work as a historian. So Dixon and Griffith managed to arrange a private screening in the White House before the film opened. It's the first ever screening inside the White House of a feature film. A private audience that Wilson's daughter was in charge of putting together, and it involves, key congressmen, members of the Supreme Court, and it was a very successful evening.
Both a political endorsement, it seems, and a major marketing coup, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. And, you know, interestingly, the ground rules for the screening were, from Wilson and his aides, that it be a private screening, invitation only, and then no one known about it, in effect off the record, because Wilson's wife had died the summer before, and Wilson didn't really want it getting out that here he was entertaining in this extended period of grief.
Isn't that interesting that Wilson was more concerned about the propriety of observing mourning rituals than he was about bringing a remarkably racist film in?
Yeah, exactly. So those were the terms of engagement, so to speak, for the film. And yet, immediately after the film was over, and it had been a roaring success, Wilson gave his blessing to the film. Before he went home that night, after the White House screening, Griffith sent a telegram, which I came across in my research, to one of his favorite entertainment writers at the Los Angeles Times, a woman named Grace Kingsley, who had a column. And he sent her a telegram that she then used in her column over the weekend called At the Stage Door, which included the item, President Wilson and his cabinet members viewed the Klansman, as it was then called, yesterday in the Washington, D.C., according to a telegram received last night from David Griffith. So Griffith didn't hesitate to get the word out.
Wow, that was taking a bit of a risk crossing the president that way, but again, it seems to have paid off. Okay, so Griffith's got this technically innovative film that is wowing audiences. Of course, it has this terrible racist perspective. How do he and Trotter, Monroe Trotter up in Boston, come into conflict?
Because the film opens in Los Angeles in February of 1915, and the then still very new NAACP, which had a branch there that was just getting started, voiced concern about the content, but it was more like background noise. The movie then moved to New York City in March, where that background noise got a little louder because that was the headquarters of the NAACP, and they were beginning to mobilize opposition to the film. And then it went to Boston in early April of 1915. And Griffith and his producers had said that given Boston and its abolitionist history, they knew they were in for a fight in Boston. And their take on it was, if we can get the film through Boston, we can play it anywhere. So that kind of set up this dramatic confrontation, because Griffith accompanied the film to Boston, and there was met by Trotter, along with the leaders of the Boston branch of the NAACP, who wanted to stop the film from being screened and shown in Boston. They wanted to censor it. You know, that was the opposition strategy, was to shut the movie down.
That was, of course, a much more common thing back in those days. You point out in your book that the phrase banned in Boston became very common because they were known for their puritanical censorship of movies. So I guess, you know, even though today, of course, We're very protective of the First Amendment. We don't like the idea of shutting down anybody's speech, even the most offensive. Back in those days, it was considered much more common. So essentially, Monroe's Trotter's argument was, you know, if you can ban something for being too racy, certainly you can ban something for being injurious to an entire group of people.
Yeah, no, that's really a great summary, because Boston was known, especially its mayor, James Michael Curley, for banning racy, you know, short films or plays where dancers had bare legs and whatnot. So why not be able to ban something that's racist? That's a great summary. And I have to say, Stuart, you know, being a journalist and everything, and here Trotter was a newspaper editor, at the front end of the research, I'm kind of rooting for him because this film's so awful, but the idea of banning something, censoring, you know, I'm bringing to it my 21st century's perspective and sensibility about the First Amendment and free speech and a free press. And I'm going, gosh, you know, Monroe and the NAACP, is that really the answer? So part of the neat complications of this and the challenge is putting yourself and putting the reader back in time. And as you said, the First Amendment was kind of more narrowly construed than it is today. Censorship was far more widespread. The First Amendment rights seemed to be more centered around the press, and not extending into the arts in the way that it is today. So right. Capturing and reconstructing all that was both challenging and fun. And I was heartened to see that Trotter, for example, and Du Bois, in theory, as an idea, didn't really like the idea of having to pursue censorship. And in a perfect world, I think, you know, they even talked about trying to get a competing movie going. That would be an answer to Birth of a Nation. In other words, fight speech with speech.
Yeah.
But they didn't have the financial resources that the white filmmakers did.
I'm not going to suggest at all that I'm in favor of censorship, because I'm not. And I agree with you, the remedy for bad speech is more speech, not less speech. But those, as you point out, those are relatively modern perspectives on this. And there is a counterargument. And the counterargument, you know, goes basically like this, that certain works of art or journalism or literature are so harmful, and their harm stems from the fact that they're so well done, that we should be able to find some sort of way to suppress them. And a couple of examples that come to mind are Henry Ford's book, The International Jew, which was ghostwritten by one of his minions and was very well put together, and at least on a superficial level, very persuasive, promoting anti-Semitism. And then that, of course, was adopted by the Nazis, including Adolf Hitler, and, you know, look where all that led. And then, speaking of Hitler, he had a filmmaker. She was marvelous. Her name was Leni Riefenstahl, and she did that wonderful film, Triumph of the Will, about the 1936 Munich Olympics, which was very pro-Nazi and put Hitler and the Nazis in a very positive light. That's the counter-argument, and I think that's where Monroe Trotter was coming from.
One of the things Trotter and the others were arguing is that they had evidence and testimony from black patrons of the movie who would come out and they overheard white patrons talking about lynching blacks. And
using
Them. So there was a sense that the film was actually inciting lynching or violence, and that gave it an extra edge that is part of this argument, saying that for that reason it ought to be shut down.
Yeah, and speaking of reactions, I think one of the more poignant points that you make was that story about Griffith's own housekeeper, the African-American woman, and her reaction to the film.
She went to Griffith and I'm paraphrasing, in effect, said, "How could you have done this? Don't you know what you've done, the harm and the hurt that you've caused?"
The hurt that he'd caused her personally. "You've really hurt me, Mr. Griffith,
yeah,
by portraying my people this way." When you bring it down to individuals like that and you talk about hurting their feelings and how this must have been so painful for them, I think that really brings it home, the power of a really well-made piece of horrible propaganda.
There was a New Yorker writer a couple of years ago, in anticipation of the 100th anniversary of this film, had a great line, kind of restating what you're saying. This reviewer said, "The worst thing about The Birth of a Nation is how good it is."
Which reminds me of yet another film, Gone with the Wind, which, because of its technical superiority, and because that means that it's still shown these days and is still watched simply for its entertainment value, I would submit that that film, building upon Birth of a Nation, may have done actually more harm than Birth of a Nation itself did, though I would defer to your judgment in that regard.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It continues, to embed in popular culture depictions of blacks as lawless and violent and dangerous to American values. And these stereotypes are rooted in the images that were popularized in Griffith's movie.
Right. It seems to me to be almost a natural progression, one to the next. But we're straying a little bit from your particular storyline, and in the time we have left, I wonder if you could tell me how it all ended up with Griffith and with Trotter. I think they had very different endings to their lives, didn't they?
They did. And as far as the battle over the film, in Boston, Trotter took this battle to the streets. She got arrested for protesting against the film outside of the Tremont Theater where the movie was being screened. They were in court. They tried to change the censorship law at the State House through enlisting the support of the then Governor Walsh to rewrite the censorship law in Boston to try to stack the votes. It looked like for a while, again in real time in that time, going back, that they were going to succeed, that they were going to get the new censorship board that Mayor Curley oversaw to run the film out of town just as for being racist, in addition to the raciness of other entertainments. But at the end, they didn't have the votes. So Griffith prevailed. The film played on into the fall. It was long running. The film moved all around the country. It was a high water mark for both men in some respects. Griffith, continued to make film. He could write his own tickets, but he never had the success commercially that he had with Birth of a Nation. And he ended, he lived a fairly long life and retired in Hollywood as kind of a director emeritus.
Mm-hmm.
Trotter, meanwhile, faded from public view, at least nationally, from the national stage, in the years after this movie protest, I think for a number of reasons. One of was that his wife, Deanie, died in 1918 from the influenza plague, and they have been inseparable throughout all of this, and I probably should have referred to her earlier. She helped him put out the paper. She helped with the protest. She was always there with him, and he was never the same after that. The other key factor is that the NAACP became the civil rights organization in America. Trotter would have none of it. He would not join the NAACP. And mainly because in the beginning, the NAACP had been founded and run for the first 10 years or so by white liberals, white progressives. And Trotter philosophically was opposed to any civil rights organization for black Americans that was not run by black Americans. So I think he ended up being left behind because Du Bois was part of the leadership of the NAACP. It got a lot of traction from the film protest, and it became the national civil rights organization. And Trotter was in some ways marginalized and left behind.
Once again, it's available now. And what's the title?
The title is The Birth of a Nation: How a Legendary Filmmaker and a Crusading Editor Reignited America's Civil War.
And that's available now?
Sure is.
Well, then let's hope everyone goes out and buys a copy and also goes and checks out that film. It's a 3-hour film, but it is an important part of history. And I think it was Griffith himself who late in life started suggesting that maybe it should be watched, but only by film students, right?
He did, and that was the one, because he defended the film for so long and for so many years. But in retirement in Hollywood, I came across notes of from an interview that a would-be biographer that never got written, comments that Griffith made that he felt that the film maybe perhaps was too inflammatory, and that should not be, and children should not see it, and it should only be something that grown-ups can view. So, again, this predated the rating system that movies now have, but I guess he was saying it should have an R rating.
And that may be the case, but I would actually quibble with Griffith, too. I think people should see this because I think that we have to face this history and we have to face it squarely. So I thank you for writing this book to bring this this episode and this film to people's consciousness. And I thank you for speaking with us today.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've just finished a wonderful discussion with Dick Lehr. He's a professor of journalism at Boston University, and he was telling me about his new book, The Birth of a Nation, about the film of that same title that was released to great acclaim about 100 years ago, but has subsequently, it hasn't really withstood the test of time. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll have a change of pace. We'll talk to my old buddy Chris Phillips about a new project that he's working on. Stick around.
In the period leading up to independence, Virginia took a leading role in the cause of American religious freedom. In 1774, 22-year-old James Madison had written to a college friend that he longed once again to breathe the free air of Pennsylvania. He complained that in Virginia, the diabolical, hell-conceived principle of persecution rages among many lawmakers and clergy. But attitudes in the Commonwealth soon changed, with efforts led by Madison, George Mason, and Thomas Jefferson. Mason's preliminary draft for the Virginia Declaration of Rights provided that the exercise of religion should receive the fullest toleration. Madison took the language further, proposing what would become a new standard for freedom of conscience. Virginia's Convention of 1776 adopted Madison's proposal that all men are equally entitled to the free exercise of religion according to the dictates of conscience. With the Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And if you're a regular listener, you've heard me speak to my buddy Chris Phillips, the author of Socrates Cafe and Constitution Cafe, and the progenitor of many very interesting ideas, all of which have to do with the concept of expanding democracy. And recently, Chris and I were talking, and he returned to one of his pet subjects. And that pet idea is that children should have more of a say in our government. What an interesting idea.
I am actively engaged in making sure that youth can tap into their rabble-rousing spirit and apply it in ways that they want to, so that they can realize their own vision for our democracy.
So you're not content with rousing the adult rabble, you're rousing the toddler rabble as well.
I believe that the adult rabble will never be sufficiently roused unless young people show us the way and inspire us and set an example for us.
Well, you know, there is some basis for that because, generally speaking, young people are much more of the fire eaters than their elders are. So I can see some basis for that. But my question is that a good thing?
I don't think we'll know unless we actually give them that chance. My operating premise is that it's not only a good thing, but a great thing, and that our democratic thing will just keep going on the downslide until and unless we overcome our trepidations towards our youth.
Okay, let's do some defining then. When you speak about youth, who are you talking about?
Well, in terms of two projects that I have ongoing right now, I'm talking about middle and high school kids who quite often are left out. And in this case, I'm talking about middle and high school kids who are at the margins of society and whose voices are rarely heeded and heard, and yet I believe have their fingers on the pulse of exactly what's needed to resurrect and resuscitate our democratic experiment at a time when it's woefully ossifying.
Okay. So are you talking about simply listening to them, giving them a platform to speak, or are you talking about actually giving them some sort of political right, like the right to vote?
I think definitely they should have the right to vote on whether they want the right to vote, and maybe even on what things they would want to vote on. I suspect that, as I've written in my Huffington Post columns, that if they were given the right to vote, that they would want formidable clout on how funding is dispersed for education and what educational policy should actually amount to at a time when they spend way too much of their time in public schools just preparing for tests. But above and beyond that, I truly believe that young people, at a time when many of us older folks are telling them that they need a year of mandatory service to our communities, and there's many projects of that sort that are trying to get them involved in very specific sorts of civic participation, that we need to step back, take a foundational step back and say, wait a second, we're already just giving them sort of prepackaged the range of things that they might involve themselves in, instead of letting them discover, articulate, and share their own unique political voice and then chart a path for how they want to go about bringing us towards greater self-determination. Quite often, we adults like to tell them exactly how to go about doing things. And I think that's condescending at best. And we're assuming that we know better than they do in terms of how they might be involved. But I also think, Stuart, that there is that fear factor, that if we really let things loose and open up the floodgates and let them genuinely decide how to participate, they might take us along breathtakingly new routes. There is that fear that somehow they'll bring down the curtain on civilization, that they'll just totally wreck things. And I keep saying again and again, look at the mess that we adults have created. We just keep caroming from crisis to crisis, and yet we're scared to death of our younger generation. Let's look hard at ourselves in the mirror and recognize what mess we've made of things, and that we basically have absolutely nothing to lose if we allow children and youth a much greater say and a much greater ability to chart a path for how they might want to go about achieving greater democratic evolution.
Well, you see, the problem you've got here, Chris, is that when you talk about middle schoolers, you're talking about kids as young as the sixth grade, and by my calculation, that means maybe even as young as 11 years old. Now, I was 11 once.
No, you weren't.
Sure I was, and I actually sort of remember what it was like, and I don't know if I would trust my 11-year-old self to make significant decisions, even about my 11-year-old self, let alone society at large. And I think that's the problem you've got, is that most of us...
Stuart, did you ever have anybody who came in and engaged with you on a regular basis and gave you opportunity month in and month out to allow you to overcome those doubts not in some sort of fake I am somebody sense, but in a way that allowed you consistently over a period of time to discover and develop your political voice?
I don't know. I don't know exactly how we're going to get 11-year-olds teed up so that they
can... Here's how you get them teed up.
Tell me.
First, you have to have educators who understand what they're capable of and understand that we're selling them short. Then you have to have a rabble-rousing guy, more or less like yours truly, who has a plan, who has a viable plan, who has, you know, worked in the educational sphere with kids all across the U.S. for over 30 years, and whose own experience is that we sell them short and we sell ourselves short as a result when we don't allow them to become more participatory citizens at a far younger age. We tend to look at them as always citizens in the making and never citizens made. We need to see them as both, and we need to see ourselves as both too. So in my two sort of signature projects for Democratic Revolution, Evolution, Constitution Cafe, and then this relatively new Declaration Project, I have been very fortunate to team up with educators, quite often educators who work with at-risk youth who are kindred spirits with me and who absolutely share my operating premise and are with these kids at the front lines and understand how Constitution Cafe and our Project not only gives kids on an individual basis that confidence you spoke of to believe that they can make a difference in society right here and now, but the tools to do so, and more importantly than anything, the voice to do so.
Okay. Well, you've been very busy with two aspects of that project recently, and tell us about those if you would.
Well, I started a Constitution Cafe at East Central High School in San Antonio, Texas in 2012 with a wonderful educator for at-risk youth there named Patty Reyes. And I had come to San Antonio to give a presentation about my Constitution Cafe work. And Constitution Cafe, we give people the opportunity to put on their constitutional framers cap and to determine whether the Constitution we have is the one that they want or whether they would make changes to it. And if so, what those changes would be and then how they would go about realizing them. So I gave a presentation about that, and Patty Reyes was there with about 20 of her kids. And the kids afterwards said to her, "Wow, he actually talks to us like we're equals." And she picked up on that, and she saw this as an unbridled opportunity to try something new. I mean, this is an educator who's been with them for several decades, who's been in the public school system with kids who are at best first generation college students whose parents have not gone to college. And she saw this as an opportunity and one promising means to get them more involved. Thanks to another person who happened to be at that gathering, a man named Paul Martin, who's now on Democracy Cafe's nonprofit board. That's the nonprofit that I founded. He was there as well, and he saw the magic that occurred, and he has been a godsend in providing me with the funding to travel out there regularly. And so now for nearly the past 4 years, I've been traveling to this high school in San Antonio, Texas, with at-risk kids, and I've been able to see and track, in many cases, their borderline miraculous transformation from kids who have little self-belief and who are quite often in tandem with that had little or not a great grasp of the traditional three R's, who now have no problem speaking passionately, eloquently, and Stuart, most important of all, rabble-rousingly, about their highest aspirations and hopes for our democracy and how they might make those come true. So they've been gathering and talking about constitutional issues as a springboard for more direct and deeper involvement in civic participation, because the idea isn't just some sort of feel-good exercise where you sort of do have thoughtful discussions with people of many walks of life about the Constitution, and where middle and high school kids are engaged with as equals by school board members, police officers, and other community denizens, but where they actually have a chance to show us the way and to develop schemes for applying their ideas. And it's been eye and mind opening for all of us. What's also been instructive is that this is our fourth year, and what's happened is that these kids are applying to go to college. These are kids who typically don't apply to. And so the superintendent of schools, who has attended most of the gatherings, is absolutely convinced that it's because of the Constitution Cafe.
As long as we keep it to education, and certainly as long as they're allowed some input into the political process.
Well, let me ask you something. Mm-hmm. What isn't educational about any of this? Whether it's in the formal sphere or informal sphere?
Nothing. I'm simply reacting to the idea of actually giving them actual political power.
Stuart, what do we have to lose?
Well,
we have a sea of intolerance in our nation right now. Our do-nothing Congress, president who can't enact any policy. Look at what's going on around the world. And we're at a really crucial crossroads and maybe even a precipice. What do we have to fear about giving more license towards creating pathways to self-determination for our young people?
Anarchy comes
to
mind.
What's going on right now?
Well, we do have a fair degree of civilization, and I certainly will. I'm not going to argue.
And they're the bedrock of it. I have seen, you have to understand that my operating premises about my faith in kids are born from hard-won experience. I have traveled for years now relentlessly across the U.S. and engaged with young people. I have seen, if anything, that it's the middle school kids who are the most thoughtful and articulate. What I've also seen is that, you know, it's one thing to go there one time, it's another thing to create a regular platform for them that helps them develop their political views and voice in a responsible and yet rabble-rousing way. They're not mutually exclusive. So again, these are programs that are meant to engage them over the long haul. And the proof is in the pudding. If you could see how civil, thoughtful, engaged, intelligent, and impassioned these kids were and continuously are at East Central High School, all of your fears would be assuaged. There's not the slightest question about it. You should see how adults go into these gatherings and how they leave just feeling not just reassured about the promise of our youth, but absolutely inspired and enthused in a most exhilarating way about the possibilities because of the youth that they've engaged with.
Well, again, I wish you the best, and I'm glad you're having such good experiences. But since we are running a little short on time, you have something else you wanted to talk about as well.
Yes. Well, as you know, I have an ongoing project, the Declaration Project, which anyone can see at declarationproject.org. And the staple of that is something called My Declaration, which gives people the opportunity to post their own personal declarations around what they feel are grievances, about what's glaring gaps in our country that need to be addressed if we are going to be the democratic society, the beacon on the hill that we profess to be. But they also gives them a chance to sort of declare their own sort of civic rights and responsibilities. And the other place where I've had a long time relationship, the other high school, is Constitution High School, a public high school in inner city Philadelphia. I began there in 2009. These are kids who not only want to address constitutional matters, but always present potential solutions for what they think ails not just their community, but society as a whole. Mm-hmm. And they have posted now about 20 declarations in our My Declaration section of our declarationproject.org site. I'd like to just, among an embarrassment of riches, I'd like to point out two to you.
Okay.
One is this absolutely gorgeous Declaration of Independence from Silence. This was one posted by Jazz Marie Vega, a high school student at Constitution High School. When you bear in mind that these kids are never asked what they think, when they rarely, if ever, have an opportunity to develop and articulate their voice, and when you see the homework that they've done, because you don't just write these things in a heartbeat. It takes time. They studied our original declaration. They adapted that to their own purposes, as have all the most meaningful declarations in most cases over time. So here is here's a part of Jazz Marie's Declaration of Independence from Silence. She says, "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for a community of people to speak out against the crimes and injustices that have been done to them by other people, and to demand mutual respect and equality, it is their duty to do so. Some hold these truths to be self-evident, that we are and ought to be equal, regardless of gender, sexual orientation, race, ethnic background, and that this is one of our many unalienable rights." She goes on to write, "And to secure such rights, we as a people must use the power in our freedom of speech to uplift ourselves from the wrongdoings of society based upon their biased actions and words. Too many lives are lost and spirits broken by the harsh actions and ways of people with certain prejudices. We as a people are stuck in this cycle of an ancient battle for the upper hand, for privilege and upliftment of our own community, even if it means the pitfall of other communities. While victims, we are still very much so to blame for this ongoing fight for power and glory. We unknowingly contribute to the fueling of this hate fire in our admittance to silence. And so, Jasmarie concludes, I declare my independence from this silence, the silence that has kept too many in oppression, the silence that has occurred in classrooms and business places when others are harassed. I, as an individual, dissolve the bonds and ties that I have to this perpetual ignorance, and I vow to use my newly declared independence to encourage others to do so as well.
That's a heck of a declaration.
It's a hell of a declaration. And how can we possibly fear students who have this type of ethos? Our founding fathers would see them as direct kindred spirits. We need them desperately. We need them desperately if we are to get back on track. And this, again, this is a student who has probably never before had a chance, and she put her heart and soul into this. This is a student who's going to make a difference throughout her life. And I just, you know, I'm just so grateful that we have citizens like this. She's so far above and ahead of me, and it's just wonderful to have developed this platform at declarationproject.org that she can show me the way and show the rest of us the way.
Well, I agree with you on that, Chris. And in fact, declarationproject.org is one place that we're going to encourage everybody to go and check these out. And you also have democracycafe.org, right?
I do. That's the sort of umbrella group for all these various initiatives.
Right. democracycafe.org. And people can go there and they can access all of your materials and see all the good stuff you're doing and also make contributions, I'm sure.
You know, that would be really nice. traditional film, and I wish it was laughable. When I think of this is basically in terms of developing the platform has been the work of me and the youngest board member of our nonprofit, Danielle Olson. She's 30 years old, and she's probably given $30,000 worth of in-kind work because she believes so much in the Declaration Project and what it can achieve.
Right.
I've been rejected by one philanthropic group after another. And frankly, Stuart, it's been very interesting. It's been for, they won't put this in writing, but when they talk to me on the phone, it's for quite often, if not always, the reason that you yourself sort of posed to me, though you're sort of being a devil's advocate. It was, I'm not so sure I want to give young people license. So I do these things anyway. I do them totally on a wing and a prayer, and because I believe it's what our society needs. If I waited for philanthropic funding, I would have never started any of my initiatives, including the one I'm really branded for, which is the 20-year-old long-going Socrates Cafe initiative. When philanthropics told me it sounded too good to be true, and so I thought, well, okay, I don't think that's the route I'm going to go to support this, and I just did it. You know, sometimes. Nike commercial sayings are actually true. Sometimes you just got to do things and just come with me.
Well, good luck with it, Chris, and thanks very much for speaking with us today.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Chris Phillips for telling us about his latest rabble-rousing adventure. I guess eventually the kids will just be in charge. Thanks also to Dick Lair, who told us about his book, The Birth of a Nation, all about that fascinating artistic triumph, The Birth of a Nation, that also happened to be a terrible screed of racism. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Center for the Constitution at Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.